Chenayan Winery for a tasting of Peter's wines. Then from 8 to 10, live jazz and pop music with the Salamanders. Information at 337-7704.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to this program a couple of guests who every once in a while are here and bring with them new books to recommend. And we always have a good time when they are here. I have appreciated some of their recommendations. I know people listening have. And they are Philip Graham and Tanya Leotsakos. And Philip is a writer. He teaches here at the U of I in the creative writing program. And Tanya works out at Pages for All Ages bookstore. And they are both big readers. And that's not surprising, as you would expect. They're always on the lookout for something new. And when they're here on the program, they bring some new books that they have come across that they have enjoyed. They'll talk a little bit about them. We have all of the information will be on our soon, not quite yet, but maybe within about the next 5 minutes, will be on our website. So if you don't quite get the names and of the authors and the titles, they'll be there on the website. And also, if people who are listening, if there are books that they would like to recommend, you can do that, too. Maybe you've been reading something you thought was really good, and you'd like to call in and tell other people about it. You can do that, too. Whatever you like. 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, I'm glad to have you here, and we appreciate it.
Always nice to be here.
I was thinking that I could introduce it by saying, you know, most of the times you've been here recently have been when we were asking for money, and that it was nice to have you here when we're not asking for money. But, of course, we are asking for money.
We always need money.
We always need money. So maybe there's almost no time which we're not asking for money. Anyway, we did think that it would be a good time to have you come back, as people are maybe they're lucky enough to get some time off over the summertime. Maybe they'll be traveling. Maybe they'll be going to the beach. Maybe, you know, whatever it is. And they're saying, I want some good stuff to read. So this is
in, we brought the good stuff.
They brought the good stuff. If you're looking
for
good summer reads, we have some suggestions. And as I said before, if people are listening, if you want to suggest a book, that would be great. So who wants to start?
Me?
Tanya's pointing at
Philip.
Okay,
Philip.
I'll start on something.
I love this title.
Quickly. Yes, it's called The Truth About Stories, A Native Narrative, and it's a book about what stories are like and what, in particular, Native American stories and storytelling is happens to be like. This is by the writer, the Canadian writer Thomas King, who's a Native writer. He's a wonderful novelist. His novel Medicine River is one of my favorite novels, and this is a brief, and it's very funny, but it's also very profound in many, many ways. And he always starts off each chapter by telling the same story, but he changes it a tiny bit each time, and I like that a lot. This is a story that happened to him when he was a younger man, when he was teaching in Canada. I had been teaching at Lethbridge for about a month when a couple of young men from the Blood Reserve, Native Reserve, arrived at my house. Narcisse Blood and Martin Heavyhead. Both of them played basketball in the All-Native League, and they had come to talk me into playing for the team. I told them I was too old and too slow. I told them I couldn't dribble or shoot. It's okay, Narcisse told me. You're nice and big and can get in the way. So I said yes. I was lonely. Wanted to be liked. Wanted to be accepted. Even if I couldn't play, I could at least make the effort. But in the first game, I was amazing. Every time I lumbered to the basket, the other players got out of my way. When I took a shot, no one tried to stop me. I scored 6 points that night. The next game, I scored 8. The matter began to unravel in the third game. One of their guards drove the lane. I stepped in front of him, tried to block the shot, and both of us went down in a heap. The guard who had run into me leaped up, concerned. You okay? Sure, I told him. Nothing rattled loose, eh? I have to admit, no one had ever asked me that. Rattled loose? You know, the guard said, looking embarrassed. The plate. Plate? I said. What plate? In your head. It turned out Narcisse had told the other teams that when I had come up from Salt Lake City, I had run into a hailstorm, lost control of the truck, and flipped it. A serious accident that left me with a plate in my head. Everything was okay as long as I didn't get bumped, because if I did get bumped and the plate slipped, I would go berserk. It happened once during a practice, Narcisse had told everyone, and the guy was still in the hospital. I don't have a plate in my head. And with that imprudent remark, my basketball career went down the toilet. As soon as the rest of the teams in the league found out that they were no longer in danger from plate slippage, I was a marked man. I don't think I scored 2 points the rest of the season.
Very nice.
That's nice. Very
the nice. Truth About Stories, a Native Narrative by Thomas King.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, do you want to...
Yeah.
Done?
You take I'm so excited about this one. It's called Torture the Artist. It's a novel by Joey Gobel. I think this is his second novel. He used to be in a band, which is why I guess I avoided reading his first novel.
Something against musicians?
Not at all. I absolutely love them. But usually when someone from one art tries to, bleed over to another
that's
one.
That's true. But there's a novel called Nalda Said by a British
musician. Oh, I know
musician.
The book. Yeah, yeah. You've recommended it.
Yeah. And he's in, what's I can't remember the band name. Or,
I don't remember.
But anyway, he's in a very popular British band. And that is a terrific novel. Short,
this as
terrific
well.
Novel.
Huh. This as well. Also short. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I skipped over the first novel, and then this one came out, and I had a friend at work who read it and said, "Oh, you would really like this," and so I do. This is a really revolutionary idea for this novel. First of all, it is hilarious. It's real fun. It's great summer reading, but it's also very darkly funny. It's about. This would be, if it weren't so unethical, this would be a great thing to try in the real world.
Don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah, don't try this at home. Okay, so there's this big, rich, bigwig guy who, his name's Lipowitz, and he owns, he basically owns the entertainment industry. Like Disney or Time Warner or something. He's the CEO of these two companies that have merged together, and they all their subsidiaries are all of the companies that make blockbuster summer movies and, you know, top 40 pop radio and kind of trashy novels and things like that. Most of the crap that we see actually out there in the world, he's responsible for all of this. Nobody really knows who he is because he just sits behind a big desk all day. But he has a lot of money and a lot of power. And he spent his whole life being greedy and trying to put this stuff out to the public, not caring what it is, just whatever sells. Now he's like 85 and he's dying of cancer. So he feels pretty bad. He knows all the stuff he's been putting out there is garbage. All the stuff he's been supporting is garbage. And so now he's feeling a sort of an obligation to the world, and he'd like to leave something worthwhile in the world and sort of change the direction of things. And since he has all this money and power, he thinks he's probably going to be able to do this. So he develops a company called the New Renaissance. And, okay, get this. The idea of the company is that you take – it's a school, really, and you take children – about the age of between, like, kindergarten age, mm-hmm. between 5 and 7 or so. He interviews, well, not he, but all of his mm-hmm. henchlings, interview all of these kids that have applied to go to this school for free. Kids who have artistic potential. And, you know, all parents think their kids have artistic potential, creative potential, but they narrow it down to, you know, a select few. And the idea is that true art, good art, in whatever its form, comes from people who get their inspiration from sorrow and from pain.
Uh-oh.
Thus the novel, thus the title, Torture the Artist, right? So the idea is to take a kid who has all this creative potential in the first place and to assign him a manager, quote unquote, to help him with his education and his career and to ensure that he always has inspiration, to ensure he's always lonely, to ensure that he's always poor, to ensure that so that he'll continue to pump out good, creative stuff that, you know, helps the world. This is his idea, right? So the novel's told from the perspective of this fellow who is the manager of this young man, Vincent, who does have a lot of creative potential, particularly with writing. And music, but mostly writing. And he definitely has a bad family situation. It takes place mostly in Indiana, this novel. And he lives, you know, on a rural farm. Like, his mother has a lot of kids by a lot of different men, and she doesn't – she's a really horrible mother. It's not that she beats him or anything, but she just simply ignores him. She just doesn't care, and she's had a couple of babies addicted to drugs and things like that. So he has a lot of pain in his life already. But this guy, they hire him because he writes music reviews, and he hates everything that's out there. Right.
A novel by a musician.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He hates everything that's out there. And so they say, you know what? You know, Lipowitz says, we like that. We like what you're saying. We think everything you're saying is true, and we want you to come and work for us. So this is the letter that this is the very first page of the book. This is the letter that our manager writes to young 7-year-old Vincent before he embarks on this journey with him. I'm so sorry to be the one to tell you this, but you will never be happy. I don't mean to hurt you by saying that. I say it because I think it is only fair that I be honest with you before we begin. I hope you appreciate this, because no one will be fair or honest with you from here on out. So again, I'm telling you right now, you will never be happy. I've put it in writing for you, and you're very welcome. I want you to go outside on the sunniest, sweatiest day of the year and quietly say it aloud. I will never be happy. Even in the heat, you should be able to see your own cold, smoky breath acknowledge the statement. The only way to avoid seeing your breath is to say it proudly, like a wise man. I will never be happy. Try it sometime. When I think of you, I think of a cartoon cloud hovering over your head, a private torrential downpour. I see you soaking wet, your entire being drooping, and you're always sick because you can't stay dry. Depressed by the bad weather, you cry yourself a little river, but the tears evaporate and form into another cloud that rains on you even more. You can't win. It will be sad. You will never get the girl. You will not save the world. You will never find true love. You will not find a trustworthy friend. You will never be satisfied. You will never have enough. The grass could always be greener. The grass will always need mowing. Your days will be long and contain no fun. Your nights will be lonely and not much else. You will always be waiting for better days that will never arrive, and you will most definitely never have peace of mind. There will always be days when you collapse to your knees and screamingly plead your case to whatever might be listening, but the thing called God can't help you, and it won't. I think of heaven as being a radiant, crystalline metropolis, and in the tallest, sparkling skyscraper, the mayor stays busy making deals behind a door with no knob. He's forever inaccessible, not taking calls at this time. And then I envision all the perfect blonde angels, devoid of genitalia and feet, congregating and pointing and laughing at all of us down here, saying, "Those poor little things," in between giggles, "they will get a kick out of you." We are more likely to answer or not answer your prayers than they are. We will control your destiny and watch over you. Not gods or angels, not the dead. Us, men and women, adults with tangled webs and hidden agendas, former children. We will allow you your needs, but deny you your wants. We will see to it that any requirements for long-term happiness are kept just out of reach. If by some mistake you experience a sensation that resembles happiness, then by all means, embrace it for all it is worth. Make the most of it, because we will not let it last. Again, I'm sorry. It's true what they say. Life's not fair, especially for you. The only consolation I can offer is that the things you will be making amid all the loneliness and suffering will by far outlast your despair and our cruelty. Our torture is temporary. Your work is forever. With this in mind, we all win in the long run. So on behalf of everyone that you will ever meet, I apologize in advance for every heartache we will cause. You're in for a tough time, kid. Consider yourself warned. Nevertheless, Harlan. So that's how it starts, right? So it's darkly funny, pretty darkly funny. There's just one other thing I want to read from it, which is a review that Harlan wrote of CD, the review that actually tipped off Lipowitz.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Okay, this is a review of a record by the artist Depraved. Depraved.
I don't like it already.
Yeah. It pains me to waste this very ink on critically appraising a band like Depraved. After all, this is the valuable space that could be used to squeeze a little more cleavage into this publication. However, it would be a sin to excuse this abomination of an aural experience from the severe chastising it so fully deserves. I'm once again amazed that enough people had enough faith in an album like this to actually get it recorded, let alone mass-produced and unleashed upon the public. Of course, that Depraved has been given a future makes perfect sense considering the country that spawned it celebrates mediocrity and shuns anything resembling originality. Thus, Depraved's bland, average sound should find success in America, considering that audiences here will simply settle for anything in ways of entertainment. It's on TV. It must be good, right? Wrong, fool. That such pure staleness and banality could be encapsulated and processed into compact disc form and released with hundreds of thousands of dollars behind it has nothing to do with quality. Bands like Depraved, and there are a lot of them, or more specifically, the businessmen who allow bands like these to flourish, are entirely quantity-driven. Their job is to minimize risks by going for the easy sell, and their creed is be safe and profit. And these days, judging by their uninspired output, independent labels are just as guilty. I can almost hear the conclusion of the meeting that made the release of Always and Never possible. Record exec. So you're asking me to release something that is basically just a collection of predictable noises and lifeless, forgettable melodies sung in a voice that cannot be distinguished from eight other lead vocalists of bands you are blatantly copying? Moron from Depraved. Yes. Record exec. Sure, why not? You got yourself a record deal. I realize I haven't yet described the actual content of this record, nor will I because there is none. This style of so-called modern rock is a dead horse that has been beaten, skinned, sliced, refrigerated, served, eaten, digested, regurgitated, and eaten again. Without hearing a second of this record, you have heard this band, and you have seen their video. Yet you will still, in all likelihood, buy this godforsaken product. The whole situation saddens me.
Wow. Again, this is a novel titled Torture the Artist. We all have to suffer for other people's art, but that's right. The way it goes. Our guest this morning at Focus 580, Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages, or as we like to think of her, Antonia, and Philip Graham, who teaches at the U of I and is writer, and every once in a while they're here and they talk about new books, and we thought it'd be good to do a summer reading show if you were looking for some recommendations, something other than whatever the big buzz novels of the summer are, and you know what they are, because if you go down to the bookstore, they're prominently displayed.
Yeah.
If you're looking for some, I mean, and, you know, there's not wrong with big buzz summer novels.
No.
Okay. They can be entertaining just fine. But, you know, maybe you're looking for something different. The path less traveled. And
yes.
These guys will have some recommendations for you.
Whole
and
wheat, not Wonder Bread.
So you can be writing these down. I hope you're writing these down.
Yes.
But also, as I mentioned, we have them posted on our website,
yes.
WILL.UIUC.EDU.
Four-course right meal, not a TV dinner.
Okay. So it's now Philip's turn again. Go ahead.
I would like to recommend a novel by a Russian-Siberian writer named Yuri Rytkhew. That's Rytkhew. His novel, A Dream in Polar Fog. This is, I think, the first novel of his that has been translated into English. He's very well known in Russia. He is, as they say, a Chukchi. He's a member of the small national minority called the Chukchi people. And this is in that part of Siberia that is closest, actually, to Alaska. And it's a novel set in the beginning of the 20th century about a man named John McLennan. He's a Canadian sailor who has had a terrible accident while his ship was locked in the ice. And the people who live nearby make a deal to take him to a hospital and try to save him. His hands have been deeply hurt by explosives when he was trying to blow some of the ice apart so they could release their ship. And what happens is that he loses most of both hands. He's saved by a female shaman who knows how to take care of him. And his compatriots in the ship, eventually, before he is able to return, they manage to break out of the ice and they desert him. And there he is, left disfigured, alone with the people who he doesn't understand and who don't understand him. Hmm. And it's about his journey to learning how to be a person in this culture. And one of the beautiful things about this book is that you see not only the Chukchi people from the viewpoint of John McLennan, but you see John McLennan through the viewpoint of the Chukchi people. It goes back and forth, back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And there's so much adventure in this book. I mean, this is like a good old adventure novel. There's exciting things that are constantly happening, but it's also a book of philosophy in many ways. It's about how to live, how to properly live. And it's beautifully written. One of the best books I've read in quite a long time. You can't put it down, and yet at the same time, there's another aspect of the novel that wants you to slow down and savor the lessons.
I love that.
The lessons about human society and human nature and personality that are so apparent here. And you get to know so many people in this culture. You get to know John McLennan, and you see a man who starts to learn how to be. And one of the beautiful things is with his hands, the shaman and other people fashion these leather hands for him. That so he actually can do lots and lots of things through manipulating these strange but very, very particular gloves. And he ends up having a family, and he ends up in many ways defending the people that he's come to love and be a part of from the encroachments of other white people who are starting to enter into the area. This is a beautiful passage where he's talking to a good friend of his, Toko, who is teaching him how to pay attention to things, and he's teaching him how to be a hunter. And this is a story about the whale and the brotherhood of whales and humans. Every child remembers this legend, said Toko, and you should know it also because you too might be a whale's brother. A whale's brother? John had to ask again. Well then, listen, Toko said, leaning back comfortably. The old men tell us that a time long ago, a beautiful young woman lived on the shore, and such a beauty she was, that even the great sun forgot to leave the sky as it gazed on her, and the stars would shine in daylight just to get a glimpse of her. Out of her footprints grew lovely flowers, and pure water springs appeared. The beauty often came to the seashore. She loved to look at the waves and hear their murmur. She would fall asleep to the whispering of the wind and the wave, and then the sea creatures would gather on shore to get a look at her. The walruses climbed up onto the pebbled beach. The seals watched her without blinking with their great round eyes. One day a big whale was swimming past. He noticed the crowd of sea beasts on the shore, grew curious, and finally swam up close. When he saw the beautiful maiden, he was so taken with her that he forgot where he had been going. When the weary sun sat down for a rest on the horizon, the whale returned to shore, touched his head to the pebbly beach, and turned into a fine young man. The beauty saw him and lowered her eyes, shy. And the young man took the maiden by the hand and led her into the tundra to where the grasses are soft, to the carpet of flowers. And so became the custom. Each time the sun set toward the line of the horizon, the whale would come back, turn into a man, and live with the beauty as a man with his wife. The day came, and she knew that she would soon bear a child. Then the whale man built a spacious yuranga and lived there with her and returned to the sea no more. Little whale calves appeared. Their father housed them in a nearby lagoon. Whenever they got hungry, the babies would swim to shore, and there was their mother coming out to greet them. The little waves grew quick, whales grew quickly, and soon the lagoon was too small for them. They wanted to be let out into the freedom of the wide sea. It pained their mother to see them go, but what can you do? Whales are a sea folk. Her children swam off to the sea. The woman was with child again, except that this time she gave birth not to whales but to human babies. Meanwhile, the whale children did not forget their parents, often coming to shore to frolic in front of their mother and father's eyes. Time passed. The children grew up, the parents grew older. The father no longer went out hunting. Now his sons brought the food. Before their first sea hunt, their father called to them and gave them a word of parting. To one who is strong and brave, the sea is a life-giver. But remember, your brothers the whales and your distant relatives, the dolphins and porpoises, live there. Do not hunt them, but take care of them. Soon the father died, and the mother was too old now to see her sons off to the hunt. The whale people increased in number, the sons all took wives, and each had many children. More and more food was needed as the whale's descendants became the Chukchi and the Eskimo people, hunters of sea life. Came one bad year when there were few beasts to be had on the shore. The walruses forgot their watery ways to the settlement, and the Nerpa had retreated to distant islands, so the hunters had to go further and further to sea, where some were lost on the ice and some in the fathomless depths. But the whales continued to cavort and play cheerfully close to shore. And then one of the hunters, a son of the white woman, said, "Why don't we hunt the whales? Just look, mountains of blubber and meat. One carcass will feed all of us and the dogs through the winter." "But have you forgotten that they are our brothers?" the people answered him. What kind of brother are they, the hunter scoffed, if they live in the water and not on land? Their bodies are long and huge. They don't know a word of human speech. But they say, the people tried to set him straight. Old wives' tales for little children, snapped the hunter. He fitted out a big hide boat, taking with him the strongest and most skillful oarsmen. Turned out to be an easy job. One whale swam to the hide boat himself, as he had always done upon seeing his brothers come out to sea. But this reunion spelled his death. They harpooned the whale, dragged him to shore. To haul him onto the beach, they had to call up all the villagers, even the women and little children. The one who had killed the whale went to his mother's Yoranga to tell her what a treasure he'd gotten for his people. But the mother already knew and was dying of grief. "I killed a whale," the hunter exclaimed, entering the Yoranga. "Pulled in a whole mountain of meat and blubber." "It was your brother you killed," his mother answered. "And if today you have killed your brother just because he does not look like you, then tomorrow..." And then she died. Toko fell silent. John was silent, too. "And everything went from there," Toko said finally. "So now, even when a human kills another human, nobody is much surprised."
Ah.
This is a beautiful, and exciting, I must say, a very exciting book. If you want adventure, but you also want a glorious look into what it's like to be human and the various ways in which one can be human. And it's about the cold, too. So if you're on the beach and you're sweating and you're worried about those UV rays, where better to be than in the North Pole?
Ah, exactly so. That's just the kind of thing you want. When it's July,
that's right,
and it's hot and it's humid, that is exactly the thing that you want.
A Dream in Polar Fog by Yuri Rykthiel.
And this was a book, was it not written in English? Was it written in some other language?
It was written in Russian, translated from the Russian.
R-Y-T-K-H-E-U.
All right. And again, the titles will be on the website. And if you don't have internet access, we can get you the information otherwise. We're a little bit past the midpoint here with Philip and Tanya. As you can tell here, there's really nothing for me to do here on the show. But
don't you have any books to recommend?
Yeah.
I know you do. You're a big reader.
Well, actually...
You know, I bring
do you want to recommend one? That would be great.
Yes, there he goes.
Well...
I happen to have a book I know he's read and loves.
Philip, yes, indeed, has a book that I did read last year and that I liked very, very much. And in fact, I've noticed the last couple of times you've been here.
He's brought it, but you've never got to it.
Well, okay, I can do that.
Yeah, cool is that? There you go.
Now
Dan.
We can relax. All right. Kick back and listen.
The book is titled Cloud Atlas, and it's written by David Mitchell. And this is a book that I took with me when I went on vacation last year. And we always take – people always say, you guys are nuts because you do all this reading for work and then you go on vacation. What do? We read.
Yeah, but you read for pleasure.
That's true.
It's different. Yeah.
And we like to read novels. And this was a book that I picked up on impulse. I did not know anything about it or about David Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what moved me to pick up this book.
The title.
Yeah, it's a great
Perhaps
title.
Perhaps so. So I took it with me and I liked it very, very much. And this is a book that – what it is – a set of six novellas that are linked by theme and character. And you start out, and the first story is set, if I remember right, it's set in 1820, something like that, in the 1820s.
Yeah.
And it's a story about a man, an American, who has gone to Australia on a business trip. And this is in the age of sail, so he had to go by sail on a large sailing ship. And he has concluded his business, and he's on his way back. And the first novella is a story about what happens to him on the way back. And you begin reading the book, and it has very much the feel of the time, the way people talk, the things that they're concerned with. It reminded me just the tiniest bit of Patrick O'Brien. It's a sea story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're reading along, and you're reading about what's happening to this man, and you're becoming more and more involved in his story, and then it stops. In the middle of a sentence, it stops. And you're thinking, well, wait a minute, what's going on? What's going to happen to this guy? It takes you to a crucial point in the story,
yes.
And then it simply stops.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to get you to keep reading.
Well, and then you turn the page, and you find yourself in another story. It has jumped ahead in time from the 1820s to the period around, I think, in between World War I and II,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, in England and Belgium.
And it's a story of a different character. A young man who is a very gifted composer, but also who is kind of a wastrel, mm-hmm. who decides that in order to make his name, He's going to go and apprentice himself to a reclusive composer, a man who was a great composer but sort of disappeared and is old and is in ill health. So this young guy, he has this idea that he can make his own name by attaching himself to this other man who lives in Belgium. So he goes there, ingratiates himself with the man who is extremely difficult. He may indeed be a gifted composer, but he is extremely sort of difficult.
He probably went to the Torture of the Artist School,
the New Renaissance.
So you're reading along. You're becoming involved in a story. It gets to a very crucial point. It stops.
Cool.
You turn the page, and you find yourself in another story. Mm-hmm. And this happens several times. And every time it happens, you jump forward in time. Mm-hmm. And you get into a very different story, and I think David Mitchell does a really nice job of changing his style, changing the feel.
The way it's written, the time period, you feel that the
kind of language, the approach to the storytelling, the characters, everything about it seems very right to that time.
Yeah.
Except you go from 1820 to 19 teens to the 60s
and then eventually
you find yourself in a science fiction novel.
Oh, wow.
In the distant future.
Two different ones. Yeah. So then you go up to the point where you have this science fiction. And every time you do it, it stops in the middle of the story. And then you find yourself into another story.
But then do you ever get to?
Yes, because there's a central novella that's presented whole. Mm-hmm. You read that story from start to finish.
Okay.
And when it is done, you turn the page and you find that you have gone back to the previous story. And it takes up where it had started.
And so you step back and back
until the very last novella finishes the story that started when you started the book.
Okay, must read that. It's great.
But there's a hidden link in every novella that connects in unexpected ways.
I see.
To the first one.
Okay.
A very, very interestingly way. So there's one point where there's this sort of hysterical kind of English comedy, and as the guy is driving along to escape from this old person's home that he's been sort of trapped in, he drives past this research facility where the South Koreans are doing genetic cloning experiments, and then one of the futures is South Korea as a super state. All their wealth built on cloning, and so on and so forth, or there's this potboiler novel that is so badly written. I mean, but it's beautifully badly written. And again, Mitchell writes poorly to write this sort of exciting but empty book.
Right.
And it's about how maybe I'm giving too much away, but there's this bad design for nuclear reactors, and then one of the problems in the latter part is that these nuclear reactors, in fact, have all gone bad, and the world is filled with radiation. And so, each one has this funny little link that moves the narrative, even though it doesn't appear to. Yeah. It's constantly surprising.
But the end of it is where you're in the future and the sci-fi kind of.
You come back to the beginning.
No, it's sort of like in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay.
It keeps going ahead in time until you get to the middle.
And then it starts going
And then
back.
It turns around and it goes back.
Yeah.
So that by the end, you are where you started.
Yeah. That's
at
cool.
the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And it's a staggering piece of technical work, I think.
Right.
It's very exciting reading. It is a page turner, definitely.
Yeah.
As you go along, you want to know. And then when you stop that story, you get into the next one, you become engaged.
And yet
you want to know, but wait a minute, what about the other one?
And eventually you do indeed
get the payoff. And I was just blown away by this book. I thought it was a fabulous book. So I would say, read this book. Read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
A great summer book. It really is. Absolutely.
Yeah, very, very good. And then if you like that, I know he's written several other novels.
Yeah.
I haven't written any else.
I want to.
But based on that, I certainly would read other books by him.
Yeah.
Well, how about that?
David.
He did that pretty well.
He
doesn't need us anymore.
Oh, no.
it could just be the David show.
Yeah. No, you
God.
See. See, the key to this show for me is that I don't have to do anything. I can just sit here.
Oh, come on, David. Be honest. You don't ever do anything. I'm just kidding.
I didn't really want people to know that. But now that it's out there, I can't deny it.
The secret's out.
All right.
No,
well,
he works hard.
He does.
Okay. Well, now I've taken Philip's turn, so do you, Tanya,
no, I think
do you
I,
want to
it was Tanya's turn. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, this book, oh, wow. Talk about a page-turner. This is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer, And he won like the best Jewish book award for Everything is Illuminated, which I read then after this because it was so spectacular. The thing about this book, though, is that you really have to be prepared to have your heart broken. Mm-hmm. I mean, every page will break your heart. And the main character, his name is Oscar, and he's like a 10 or 11-year-old boy. And his father has been killed in 9/11. But they never found his body. He's a very unusual kid, this kid. It reminds me, did either of you read the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, loved that book. This Oscar has a sort of a way about him. I mean, they never come out and say, you know, this kid's autistic or this kid's special in some kind of way. But he just has a way about him, the language, the way he speaks. And in fact, the reason it's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is because he uses those sort of exaggerated words a lot. And he's just this charming boy who's trying to figure out exactly what happened to his father, because what he has is a series of cell phone messages made to his own cell phone from his father in one of the towers during the whole incident. He has like six cell phone messages, which he's kept from his mother because he doesn't want to. He has a great mother. Because he doesn't want to hurt her. He just thinks it'd be too sad for her to know. And there's nothing that important or valuable in the messages. He's just sort of telling his son what's going on and not to worry and that kind of a thing. So he's searching around in his dad's closet one night and, you know, sort of smelling his suits and remembering him and that kind of a thing. And he sees that a blue vase on the top shelf of his father's closet, which he's never seen before and he thinks is odd, and his father doesn't really collect that sort of thing. So he climbs up and he gets it down, and he finds in the bottom of this blue vase a small white envelope that has one word written on it, black. And inside the envelope is a tiny key. So Oscar sets about figuring out, he's convinced that this means something, that his father left it there for him as a clue, that there's a message his father's trying to get to him, because he had this really interesting, unique little relationship with his dad, because he's such a bright kid and such an unusual kid, where his dad would do scavenger hunts for him, and they would be really elaborate, like all over Central Park. And the clues he would leave would be really obscure. Like, he'd be reading the newspaper, and he'd circle these random words and leave it lying around for Oscar to find. And somehow the words would mean something. He'd have to put it all together. So this is something they did, you know, throughout his childhood. So he's convinced that this means something. So the first thing he does is he tries the key in all the locks in his house, of course, and it doesn't work. He decides that the word black, he takes it to a locksmith, takes the thing to the locksmith, and the locksmith tells him, you know, this is a key for like a safe deposit box. And so he asks his mother. He can find no, you know, trace of any safe deposit box that his family's ever had. He doesn't know why it says black. But he's convinced that the word black is actually someone's name. And, you know, he lives in New York City. There are a lot of blacks in New York City. He decides he's going to, this 11-year-old kid, he's going to set about meeting, either calling or going to the homes of every black in the New York City telephone book to try and find out if anyone knows anything about this key or anything about his father. And who he, all the characters that he meets along the way are so interesting. Even if he only meets them for a page, each character, each black is just its own story, his or her own story. Wow. The kid has a book that he calls Stuff That Happened to Me. And he puts all this stuff in the book, pictures of all these random things, like not even stuff that happened to him, just like he goes into this one woman's apartment and she has a framed photograph on the wall of an elephant's eye. And he thinks it's really beautiful because it looks like the elephant is crying. So he takes a photo of it and he puts it in his book, Stuff That Happened to Me. And he uses it for comfort. At night, he looks through the book. He eventually meets one Mr. Black who only goes by the name of Mr. Black. He's the main Mr. Black in the movie. In the movie. They should make the movie at some point in the novel. He's a really interesting Mr. Black, too. And he decides that he's going to take him on this big excursion to find all the other Mr. Blacks. Hmm. The passage I want to read is actually where he decides to tell. He goes, he knocks on the guy's apartment door. He actually lives in the same building. This Mr. Black lives in the same building as him, and he never even knew there was a Black. He knocks on the apartment door. He goes in. He has a conversation with this very old man. And then he decides it's time to tell him why I'm here. I had another cup of coffee. He drinks coffee, by the way, this 11-year-old boy. I had another cup of coffee, and then I knew it was time to get to the point. So I took the key off my neck and gave it to him. Do you know what this opens? Don't think so, he hollered. Maybe you knew my dad? Who was your dad? His name was Thomas Shell. He lived in 5A until he died. No, he said. That name doesn't ring a bell. I asked if he was 100% sure. He said, I've lived long enough to know I'm not 100% anything. And he got up, walked past the column in the dining room, and went over to the coat closet, which was tucked under the stairs. That was when I had the revelation that his apartment wasn't just like ours, because his had an upstairs. He opened the closet, and there was a library card catalog inside. Cool. He said, this is my biographical index. Your what? I started it when I was just beginning to write. I'd create a card for everyone I thought I might need to reference one day. There's a card for everyone I ever wrote about, and cards for people I talked to in the course of writing my pieces, and cards for people I read books about, and cards for people in the footnotes of those books. In the mornings, when I'd read the papers, I would make cards for everyone that seemed biographically significant. I still do it. Why don't you just use the internet? I don't have a computer. That made me start to feel dizzy. How many cards do you have? I've never counted. There must be tens of thousands by this point, maybe hundreds of thousands. What do you write on them? I write the name of the person and a one-word biography. Just one word? Everyone gets boiled down to one word. And that's helpful? It's hugely helpful. I read an article about Latin American currencies this morning. It referred to the work of someone named Manuel Escobar. So I came and I looked up Escobar. Sure enough, he was in here. Manuel Escobar. Unionist. But he's also probably a husband or dad or Beatles fan or jogger or who knows what else. Sure, you could write a book about Manuel Escobar, and that would leave things out too. You could write 10 books. You could never stop writing. He slid out drawers from the cabinet and pulled cards from the drawers one after another. Henry Kissinger, war. Ornette Coleman, music. Che Guevara, war. Jeff Bezos, money. Philip Guston, art. Mahatma Gandhi, war. But he was a pacifist, I said. Right, war. Arthur Ashe, tennis. Tom Cruise, money. Eli Weissel, war. Arnold Schwarzenegger, war. Martha Stewart, money. Rem Koolhaas, architecture. Ariel Sharon, war. Mick Jagger, money. Yasser Arafat, war. Susan Sontag, thought. Wolfgang Puck, money. Pope John Paul II, war. I asked if he had a card for Stephen Hawking. Oscar's obsessed with Stephen Hawking. He writes him letters all the time. Of course, he said, and slid out a drawer and pulled out a card. Stephen Hawking, astrophysics. Do you have a card for yourself? He slid out a drawer. A.R. Black. War, which has been crossed out, and underneath it, husband.
He cheated.
So do you have a card for my dad? Thomas Shell, right? Right. He went to the S drawer and pulled it halfway out. His fingers ran through the cards like the fingers of someone much younger than 103. Sorry, nothing. Could you double check? His fingers ran through the cards again. He shook his head. Sorry. Well, what if a card is filed in the wrong place? Then we've got a problem. Could it be? It happens occasionally. Marilyn Monroe was lost in the index for more than a decade. I kept checking under Norma Jean Baker, thinking I was smart, but completely forgetting that she was born Norma Jean Mortensen. Who's Norma Jean Mortensen? Marilyn Monroe. Who's Marilyn Monroe? Sex. Do you have a card for Mahatma Atta? Atta, that one rings a bell. Let me see. He opened the A drawer. I told him, Muhammad is the most common name on earth. He pulled out a card and said, bingo. Muhammad Atta. War. I sat down on the floor. He asked what was wrong. It's just that why would you have one for him and not one for my dad? What do you mean? It isn't fair. What isn't fair? My dad was good. Muhammad Atta was evil. So? So my dad deserves to be in there. What makes you think it's good to be in here? Because it means you're biographically significant. And why is that good? I want to be significant. 9 out of 10 significant people have to do with money or war. But still, it gave me heavy, heavy boots. Dad wasn't a great man, not like Winston Churchill, whoever he was. Dad was just someone who ran a family jewelry business, just an ordinary dad. But I wished so much then that he had been great. Mm. I wished he'd been famous, famous like a movie star, which is what he deserved. I wished Mr. Black had written about him and risked his life to tell the world about him and had reminders of him around his apartment. I started thinking, if Dad were boiled down to one word, what would that word be? Jeweler? Atheist? Is copy editor one word? You're looking for something, Mr. Black asked. This key used to belong to my dad, I said, pulling it out from under my shirt again, and I want to know what it opens. He shrugged his shoulders and hollered, I'd want to know too. Then we were silent for a while. I thought I was going to cry, but I didn't want to cry in front of him, so I asked where the bathroom was. He pointed to the top of the stairs. As I walked up, I held the railing tight and started inventing things in my head. Airbags for skyscrapers, solar-powered limousines that never had to stop moving, a frictionless, perpetual yo-yo. The bathroom smelled like an old person, and some of the tiles that were supposed to be on the wall were on the floor. There was a photograph of a woman tucked in the corner of the mirror above the sink. She was sitting at the kitchen table that we were just sitting at, and she was wearing an enormous hat, even though she was inside, obviously. That's how I know that she was special. One of her hands was on a teacup. Her smile was incredibly beautiful. I wondered if her palm was sweating condensation when the picture was taken. I wondered if Mr. Black took the picture. And as he goes on to have this conversation with the Mr. Black, the main Mr. Black, he finds out that, in fact, Mr. Black can't hear anything, that he's been reading his lips the whole time. But during this encounter, Mr. Black begins to hear. And throughout this book, there are a lot of pictures, pictures that Oscar has taken, pictures that others have taken, little squiggles, all kinds of things in between the text. And this is really the very center of the book. There's a photograph of some pigeons. And I won't say too much about it, except that it's probably one of the most beautiful, significant little things when this old man, 103, hears again for the first time. And what he hears are pigeons. And he decides to go. He thinks it's kind of some kind of a sign, really. And he decides to help Oscar find out what in the world the deal is with this key. And so he goes about meeting all of the other Mr. and Ms. Blacks.
Tell us again the title and the author.
Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. F-O-E-R.
All right. And again, they'll be on our website if you want to get the authors and the titles. And there, I think that we're almost out of time, so there will be some that Philip and Tanya won't get to talk about. But they will be. That always happens. But they'll be on the website list. Well, Philip, you can go one more time here. We've got a couple minutes left.
Oh,
do Killian.
Okay.
Well, maybe say something about the knife. There's a book we both want to recommend.
Yes, we both want to. Well, then this should win out. Though I was going to recommend that anybody
do them both fast
and get the third issue of Ninth Letter. I'm the fiction editor for that magazine, and every as I stand behind every book that I ever recommend here, I stand behind every single story in that magazine. It's a big, giant, beautiful.
Yes. It's quite
well,
nice.
And just recently, Philip and some other folks who were associated with Ninth Letter were on Afternoon Magazine talking about
the new edition. It's perfect summer reading. So. Just carry that around, and you'll get fiction and poetry and creative nonfiction. And
looks
everything.
Just about it's the same size as your laptop, so you can use your briefcase.
Big and beautiful. Okay, this is a book by Marilyn Robinson called Gilead. It won the Pulitzer Prize this year for the best novel. Marilyn Robinson is the author of Housekeeping, which is one of my favorite
and mine too.
Novels of all time. Mm-hmm. But it's been about 25 years in the making, this second novel, and I can understand why, since Housekeeping was such an enormous achievement.
It was a treasure.
Yeah. And this is a novel about a man named John Ames, who's a reverend. He's a minister, and he's about to die. He's dying. He's in his 70s. He has had a very late marriage and is married to a much, much younger woman who he feels has saved him in some way in his personal life since he was lonely for so many years after the loss of his first wife in childbirth. And the couple has a son who's now, I think, 7. And this whole book is a long – it starts out as a letter and becomes a gigantic letter, a
it
long
sure
book.
Does.
A letter to his 7-year-old child to sort of – he knows that his son is not going to know him very well by the time he dies. He knows his son will probably not remember very much about him. And because of that, he very much wants to present himself to his child. And so there's kind of a quiet desperation here in which he's talking about himself and remembering things that he wants his own child to remember about his child when he's young. So just two very short little things. Maybe I can't get to both of them. Probably not. Okay, the fact is, he says, I don't want to be old. And I certainly don't want to be dead. I don't want to be the tremendous coot you barely remember. I bitterly wish you could know me as a young man, and not really so young either, necessarily. I was trim and fit into my 60s. That was one way I took after my grandfather and my father. I was never rangy like them, but I was very strong, very sound, even now if I could trust my heart. There's a lot I could do. I don't want to fault myself for feeling this way. The Lord wept in the garden on the night he was betrayed. As I have said to people in my situation many times, so it isn't just some unredeemed paganism in me that I dread that I should welcome, though clearly my sorrow is alloyed with discreditable emotions, emotions of other kinds. Of course. Of course. And just one last tiny thing here is, if I were a child who had received this this letter, I would fall in love with the father I can barely remember by simply this observation that he writes here, which is, I was trying to remember what birds did before there were telephone wires. It would have been much harder for them to roost in the sunlight, which is a thing they clearly enjoyed doing. Mm-hmm. And there is a drama
here.
She
just has such a language, skill of language.
Yes, there is a drama here that turned out to be, in fact, much more complicated and different than John Ames thinks. And that really is what makes this novel.
There's a secret.
There is a secret, and it's beautifully done, and it's beautifully turned, and it makes the novel. And this is a book that's really deeply about religion and about a man who's deeply religious. And you don't get many good serious novels. You know, you can get these, you know, whatever it is, The Rapture, those horrible books where Jesus Christ turns into some kind of monster
right.
who's killing all the unbelievers right. and everything else, the most unchristian thing I can imagine. This is about a real Christian who believes and deeply believes. He's always talking about Scripture. And,
yeah.
and so you have this marvelous sense of a man's accounting for his life to his son, but also accounting to his God. It's a beautiful book.
It is a beautiful book.
We must stop there. The books are on our website, and go out and read some good books this summer. Thank you very much.
Thanks
Philip
so
Santana.
Much for having us.
The broadcast made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers